Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Anne Ray, and I represent the petitioner Evan Griffith. Mr. Griffith has raised 8 valid claims of substantial constitutional questions, and he deserves his day in federal court. The district court never reached the merits of his claims because the district court erred when it determined that his PLA to the Illinois Supreme Court was untimely, and ultimately his habeas petition was untimely.
If I understand your theory correctly, there's a difference between accepting a late filing and extending a period of time to file so that when something is filed beyond the original deadline, it isn't really late. But the problem that I have, I guess I'll say, depends on the perspective that one has during the period of time that nothing's been filed. There's about a 2-week period here when nobody knows. I mean, as far as everybody knows, this case is over. And 2 weeks go by, and as it happens, the petition to file in Stanter comes along after 2 weeks. It could have been 2 months. It could have been 2 years. And I take it your position is the Illinois Supreme Court has the power to accept anything like that in Stanter. But we don't know, and I thought that the rationale behind this court's decisions and the ones followed by the district court here was that there's actually just nothing pending until the petition is once again properly before the court, whatever label the Illinois courts may want to put on it, whether an ex-ante extension of time, if they'd gone to the Illinois Supreme Court and said, can we please have until the 1st of September, whatever it was, to file. There you could see why it's still pending, but there's this gap when there's nothing out there.
Well, the distinction you're making is correct. That is the distinction Fair enough. But the point is that under Saffold, and even under this court's decisions, that you have to look to state law to see what state law does. And in this case, Illinois has a procedure. You're right that they have a procedure that a motion could be filed before the expiration of the 35 days, but they also have a procedure that you can file a motion after to get a retroactive extension of that time to file. And under Saffold,
I understand your argument that Saffold is inconsistent with Fernandez, but it's an argument that this court has expressly considered and expressly rejected in De Jesus against Acevedo. And I was a little puzzled that your brief doesn't discuss De Jesus, nor does your reply brief, even after your adversary pointed out that the precise argument you're making has been considered and rejected.
Well, we're not actually arguing, because we don't think you need to get there, that Saffold is inconsistent with Fernandez or De Jesus. In Fernandez and in De Jesus, it was undisputed that the PLA to the Illinois Supreme Court was untimely. It was called a late petition. In Fernandez, that's what we saw. We're not asking you to overrule Fernandez or...
Well, your brief does ask us to overrule Fernandez, but it doesn't make any difference. I mean, what those two cases say, what De Jesus says is consistent with Saffold, is that when the state court grants an extension of time retroactively, that is, after the period has expired, the intervening time is not treated as tolling time. Now, I can't see what difference the form of words makes, whether there's any reason for a difference between whether the state court says the motion for extension of time is granted retroactively or the petition for leave to file in Stanter is granted. They seem to be the same thing. Does state law distinguish between the two of those two verbal formulations?
Well, ultimately, state law does distinguish between those two. And, you know, one of that can be seen by, in Fernandez, what was sought was a late petition, and what was sought in ours was a petition in Stanter. Right. But importantly, under the two cases that we cited...
Same thing. Is there some case in Illinois which says, no, despite appearances, those two things are different for our practice?
I don't know of a case in Illinois that specifically makes the distinction, but there are two cases in Illinois that we cite that the state and the district court didn't even address that says the procedure that our client followed was an extension of his time to file.
Exactly, but so was the procedure in Fernandez and the procedure in De Jesus. If 14 days after the time has expired, you go to the appellate court or the Supreme Court and say, I would like a retroactive extension of the time to file, and it's granted, then the petition is timely filed as a matter of state law. But under Fernandez and De Jesus, the intervening time isn't counted because until there was nothing pending during that 14-day window. I'm just trying to figure out whether there's any difference if what the state court says is the motion is granted instanter versus the motion is granted retroactively. Is there any state court that says there is a difference?
Or perhaps to put a third thing on the table is if the state court says we will accept a late petition in this instance. I don't know whether that's different from saying instanter, but it seems to be that that's the formula that you concede would not make the time tolling time. And I thought that your argument was that in the cases, in the other cases, the court has said we'll take it late, whereas in your case, they said retroactively we're going to say that the time for filing extends all the way up until when we got it.
Well, I do think there's a distinction there. And the distinction is that the Illinois Supreme Court actually treated Mr. Griffith's PLA as timely. And what this court has said in the past and what the United States Supreme Court...
So is it timely if the state court says, we'll take it late, right? From the instant the state court says, we will accept your filing, even though it's after the date, all the time is told until the state court makes a decision, right? It's properly filed if the state court says we'll take it late. So there, as Judge Wood said, there are three forms of what a state court can say. It can say we'll take it late. It can say we are retroactively granting an extension. Or it can say we're allowing filing instanter. So let me expand my question. Does some state court say that for purposes of state law, these are actually different things?
Well,
three formulations of the same thing.
First of all, the second and the third one, I think, are the same thing. That's what Illinois case law says, is that filing it and accepting it in stanter is the same thing as giving a retroactive extension of time. So I don't know that there's another distinction there. But the difference between...
How does it differ for state practice between that and the state court statement, we will accept this untimely filing?
Is there a different standard of review, for example? Does the state court, in a sense, have a plain error standard if it uses the word late versus just a plenary standard if it's a retroactive extension of time? Is there some practical difference?
Not to my knowledge, but the practical difference, I guess, comes when we bring it back into the land of federal habeas petitions.
Well, of course there's a difference for that. We know that.
Because... ultimately, it depends on what the Supreme Court said, and the Supreme Court said that it needs to be considered timely by the state courts. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time here, so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Levin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent, Warden Goetz. I'd like to start, if I could, by responding to the questions I believe Judge Easterbrook and Judge Wood asked, which is, do the Illinois courts recognize any distinction between a motion for leave to file something in stanter and a motion for leave to file something late? I believe the answer to that question is no. I believe a possibility that a court might have recognized, and I still don't think it would really have a difference under Fernandez, but had the court granted a motion for leave to file the PLA nunc pro tunc to August 17th and explicitly said we're backdating it. But that's not what the court did. The court, even under the petitioner's argument, the court is essentially just saying, in effect, when we grant a motion for leave to file something in stanter, it's as though we've granted a retroactive extension of time. Even that formulation recognizes that there was, in fact, no timely filed extension motion on file. And that's the key under Fernandez, which is that on August 18, 2005, when the time for filing a PLA came and went, without either a PLA or any other action to continue the litigation having been filed, there was nothing any longer pending in Illinois State Court.
Of what significance is the fact that Mr. Griffith had, in fact, filed this affidavit that's called for under Illinois law?
The affidavit of intent?
Mm-hmm.
The effect of that was that without the affidavit of intent, the time for filing the PLA would have been 21 days from the appellate court's judgment. By filing the affidavit of intent within that 21 days, he extended his time to 35 days. Had he then filed a PLA or an extension motion within those 35 days, we wouldn't have this problem that we have under Fernandez. I think it's important to maybe use a hypothetical here to explain how, practically speaking, there's no difference between what happened here, a motion for leave to file in Stanter, and what the court was concerned about in Fernandez, a motion for leave to file late. So, for instance, let's say, as what's common in a lot of cases, let's say Mr. Griffith here had lost 360 days up front. So he didn't file his state post-conviction petition in the trial court until 360 days had already passed. Now, that's not the case here, but I don't think it matters for the rule that the petitioner is proposing. So in that case, then, say the same thing happens as what happened here. So on August 18th, the time for filing the PLA came and went, and nothing had happened. As of that date, there's nothing on the state court docket, there's nothing pending, and he doesn't at that time have the right to file a PLA. Indeed, here he had to file a motion for leave to file it in Stanter.
But I take it you agree with Ms. Ray that by accepting the instanter filing, the Illinois Supreme Court simply proceeded to evaluate the petition for leave to appeal the same way that it would evaluate any other petition for leave to appeal.
Exactly. I agree with that. I agree that for purposes of 2244D2, the PLA was properly filed. But the question is, on what dates was the PLA pending?
No, I understand that. I guess what I'm searching for is sometimes I'll use Rule 60B motions as an example. If you file something late enough, you get a little bit of a bite at the apple, but it's a much more restricted set of eyes that look at it than if you had filed a timely Rule 59 motion. So what you're telling me is that there is no analogy to the difference between a Rule 59 motion and a Rule 60 motion for these late appeals. Once they're allowed, and they just get reviewed without any disadvantage.
I believe that's the case. I don't believe the court applied any lesser standard in Fernandez in analyzing the PLA there, and I don't believe mm-hmm. it did here.
Okay.
If I could just get back to my hypothetical, I don't know how important it is, but I think that in Fernandez, the court was very concerned with what it called the Cheshire cat-like quality that the petitioner's argument would then give to the federal habeas limitations period. So Mr. Griffith, 10 days after the deadline for filing the PLA had come and gone, had come to federal court, and he had already lost 360 days up front. At that time, the district court would have been correct in dismissing his petition as untimely. And it wouldn't have been the case that the court would have said, oh, your federal petition is not yet exhausted because you still can go back to federal court. The district court would have properly said you've exhausted your state court remedies, the time for filing your PLA has come and gone, your petition is exhausted, but it's untimely.
So I take it we all agree that if Mr. Griffith's lawyer had not decided to wait till the last day of what he thought the 1 year was, if he just pulled those 14 days off at the back end, we wouldn't be here because there was a properly filed PLA.
Exactly. And I think that goes to show, on a somewhat different point, it goes to show that there's no grounds for equitable tolling, at least with respect to the 14-day, that mistake. Because even after that had happened, the petitioner still had 350 days or so to come to federal court. And it was counsel at either a miscalculation.
Mr. Levin, this is, I suppose, not the kind of question that you want to deal with, but do you think there's anything we can do to get lawyers to actually file these things on time? Over and over and over, we see graduates of law schools waiting until what they suppose is the last day to file these things, and then they are shocked and dismayed to find that the time ran out a week earlier, or even in two prominent cases, 1 day earlier. There's no reason to wait in these cases. Is there something we can do to actually get lawyers to file them with a month to go or 6 months to go?
Improve the law school's discussion of criminal procedure.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Would actually hurt the teaching of criminal procedure because it would take away all the close cases.
Well,
you need boneheaded lawyers' mistakes in order to make good casebook cases.
I suppose so. I don't know that there's much the court could do other than what it's already done, which is to publish cases like this, putting lawyers on notice that there are certain pitfalls that come along the road to habeas corpus. Some, you know, habeas corpus is a complicated body of law, and that it's just not a good idea to wait until what you think is the last day when there's the chance.
One of the puzzles is that we almost never see tort suits filed on the last day of the tort, the 2 year in Illinois, for example, the 2 year statute of limitations. Right? Lawyers have learned to be a little more careful about that, but we see lots of these filed on the last day or the last week, as the lawyers suppose them to be.
And I don't know what the answer to that is, Your Honor. I think Congress did give petitioners a full year and recognize that along the way there will be things that come up that there will be bumps in the road, but that's why there is that full year. And Mr. Griffith did have a lot of time under that year told, and his lawyer just made a mistake here. The Supreme Court in Lawrence versus Florida recognized that that type of attorney error, what you might call mere negligence or miscalculation, is not sufficient to justify equitable tolling of the limitations period. If there are no further questions on that, I would maybe briefly like to address the other argument that the petitioner makes for equitable tolling, which is he says that, you know, the state waited 22 months to raise this defense. I think, first, that's sort of misleading. Well, that is misleading. The procedural history here is that the petitioner filed his original petition with his former counsel. The state answered, and we didn't raise the defense. We overlooked it. And the petition remained pending in front of Judge Mim for about a year. At that point, petitioner's new counsel came on and filed an appearance and asked for leave to file an amended petition, which Judge Mim granted, but instructed the parties that it would be an amended petition that fully superseded the prior petition. And I believe that would have been the case under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in any event. But at that point, the petitioner's counsel then took a number of extensions and then filed the amended petition. And at that point, the state it took us 3 months. We took a couple extensions as well. And in our first response to that amended petition, we raised the timeliness defense. So in that sense, there was not even a need to get to Judge Mim's discretion under Day versus McDonough. But even in any event, he did have that discretion. He exercised it, allowed us to file the petition, and the petitioner has not argued here that that was in any way error or an abuse of discretion. So I think the 22 months is sort of a red herring. It doesn't actually get to the question that would be asked, assuming equitable tolling is generally available. In all the cases, both this Court and the Supreme Court, when they've assumed, without deciding, but when they've assumed that equitable tolling might apply, they've always formulated the test along the lines of, did some extraordinary circumstance stand in the petitioner's way and prevent him from timely filing? And under a test like that, what the state does after the petitioner files his petition is simply irrelevant. It just doesn't enter into the equation. There's not a general concept of equity involved here. The equitable tolling standard is very specific, and it simply doesn't ask what did the state do after you filed the petition. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Ms. Wright.
I just have 2 points that I'd like to make briefly. The first one is there's been a lot of questions about whether or not something was actually pending during those 14 days that we're talking about. And those 14 days, because it was ultimately considered a timely filing by the Illinois Supreme Court, those 14 days weren't treated any different than the preceding 35 days. And we know from Saffold and a number of other cases in this court that there was nothing physically pending in the court during those 35 days either. But we consider it pending for the purpose of ADEPA's statute of limitations. And I think that's an important distinction that needs to be made. Second, this case isn't a situation like in Fernandez or in De Jesus or in many of the other cases from the other circuits. We're not suggesting that there should be no federal review of how long the state courts have to look at whether or not something is timely filed. The answer is whether or not it's actually timely filed. And here, It was 14 days, and the 14 days were because Mr. Griffith's counsel was ill during that period of time. If it had been 10 months, the Illinois Supreme Court might not have granted his petition for leave to file in Stanter. Instead, it might have allowed it late. We don't know what the Illinois Supreme Court would have done because that's not what actually happened here. It was a specific circumstance under the circumstances of this case where he was sick and the Illinois Supreme Court decided that it was appropriate to allow the petition to obtain a retroactive extension of time. And because of that distinction, we think that's an important distinction to make between this case and Fernandez. And if you have no further questions, I will just ask that this case is remanded for a full determination on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Ray, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to engage in this kind of pro bono work. The case is taken under advisement.